Welcome to Journeys of Discovery, a Changemakers collaboration with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. I'm Michael Heyman, and today we're at Cadogan Hall, where I'm joined by the designer and author, Anya Hindmarch. From her early days in Florence to becoming one of Britain's most distinctive creative voices, Anya has built a career defined by curiosity, confidence, and craft. Anya, welcome to Journeys. Welcome to Cadogan Hall, your part of town, no doubt. I mean, we're just around the corner from fashion to food. This is Anya Town.
It's very much my hood, actually. It's a real treat to be here. And yeah, very local. So thanks for having me.
Well, it's one of the residencies of the RPO. We've been listening to them rehearse for this evening's Sibelius and Strauss concert. And what they didn't know is that the orchestral members needed to know, I think, that your dream is to sort of lie in front of an orchestra on the floor. Tell us about that dream, and we almost delivered it.
I think that might slightly freak them out. No, I mean, I absolutely love music. In fact, I actually considered it as a career. And so I've always had this, mine was more about choral music, actually, but I just have always had a sort of bucket wish list of actually lying in front of a huge orchestra and just feeling the music sort of float over you. And so tonight was pretty much that, so thank you very much.
How far did you get in your musical ambitions?
Sort of grade 8 and sort of gave up when I realised it was probably not going to happen, sadly.
But music continues to be important, I suppose, to your creative expression. I mean, your fashion shows are known not only for the wonderful fashion, the wonderful bags, but the wonderful music and creativity with it. I mean, I get the sense we're missing a kind of creative director in the musical sense, conductor, if you will.
But it was fun. We actually, when we did big shows, we had the musical specially written, and actually we would get very involved in creating. And it's lovely because a show is very much about taking an idea and then amplifying it through all sort of touch points, and music is obviously such a key one of those. But I would love it when I have time, when I have more time in my life, I would love to sing again, actually. And we listen to choral music here often. And so I love music, yeah. So thank you for that treat.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And it's a wonderful thing, actually. I mean, we were just talking before the rehearsal began, is that even listening to an orchestra tune has got a kind of experience all of its own, hasn't it, in terms of...
It really does. And I think there's just something also, the fact that you commit in a day when we're so on all the time digitally, the fact that you commit to actually just being present. I mean, it's lame, isn't it, that it takes that? But it really, just walking into the hall was just good.
It's almost like a change in mood, isn't it?
Yeah.
A change
it's like when you walk into a library, there's something, it does something. Yeah, it's real.
I mean, I suppose that it's tempo, it's rhythm. How does that play its part in the creative experience in your world?
Well, it's emotion, isn't it? It's feeling. And I think that for me, fashion, which is, you know, in many ways a kind of silly subject, actually. I mean, no one needs another, you know, set of clothes on their back for as long as we live.
Anya, I think we've just had a presidential visit where you've been the epitome of soft power. So with a bag being given to the First Lady, I mean, I think that's a fairly serious contribution to the national effort. So you put your glasses on to answer that.
Seriously. But I think it's interesting. I think fashion... you know, it can be lovely gifting, of course, it can be lovely memories, but ultimately it's actually mostly how you feel. And I think that, you know, clothes and accessories and in the same way music alters your mood, and that's a very special thing. And so in some ways it's quite indulgent, but I think all those things are important.
I mean, it's an interesting, I suppose, analogous world, because there's so much creativity in both, and I'm sort of also thinking about versatility. I mean, I was with the RPO yesterday, we had Symphonic Queen, tonight it's Sibelius. I mean, there is this sort of like incredible range of I suppose musical opportunity. In the world of fashion, how does that play out in terms of, I suppose, when you're in a world one moment where you're in the world of first ladies and the royal family through it, but through to then being a brand where you've got people that will come out and buy your products on a day-to-day basis. I mean, in terms of actually that versatility, I suppose, from how you go from high fashion, I would never say high street fashion, obviously, but you have managed to capture the public consciousness. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? So, I mean, I started very much because I love craftsmanship. That's always my starting point. And I love the mood-altering nature of fashion, as I just said. So those things really interest me. What I don't love, funny enough, is the sort of status aspect of fashion. I find that not at all interesting. And yet there's quite a lot of that.
Why is that? Because a lot of your contemporaries are seem to like quite like it.
Yes, I guess. And I think there's been a whole, you know, in the many, many years I've been working in this field, there's been a range of sort of emerging markets coming out and people wanting the flashy car, the flashy watch, the, you know, expensive handbag. And so, you know, it does a thing, no judgment. But that's not the bit that interests me. I love how things are made, how it makes you feel. I love making things that last. I have a huge interest in kind of being responsible through, you know, the stuff that we don't need. And I think the sort of, you know, the range that I'm interested in, I like the fact that you can come into one of our stores and you can kind of go high or low. You know, we will work with a supermarket, on, I'm sure we'll talk about it later, on something which you can buy for sort of £13, because that has a point of view that does a certain thing, but we'll also make the most beautiful things that are bespoke and made to measure for a lot more. So I like that.
I think that there is, I mean, you and I met some years ago, and I think in all of our conversations, how you feel becomes is an important part of a lot of what we talk about. And actually, when in doubt, wash your hair. I mean, you know, which is a book, not an instruction. I mean, it's your book. It's that, but it's also a manual for feeling better, I guess, in terms of five big lessons. Tell us a little bit about why you wrote it and a lesson for listeners to take from it.
Well, I actually wrote the book in lockdown, and I had never. I don't know, I think probably I got to 50, which when I wrote that book, I'm now 57, and I had sold my business and had bought it back, and it had been a pretty uncomfortable experience. And I wrote a book, you know, the title, If in Doubt, Wash Your Hair, has the word doubt in it, and I wanted to write about self-doubt as a woman, as a creative, as a mother, as a stepmother, as a person running a business, and be really honest, because I think so often there are so many books out there, particularly for women, who talk about lean in and, you know, all brilliant, and they're all really good books, but actually not being really honest about how vulnerable you feel. And actually, I think being open about the fact that that has to be the normal, that is the norm. Everyone feels like that. And so I wanted just to write a really honest book about all those things.
Because to the outside eye, people would assume, here's somebody that is uber confident, has made it on anybody's measure. You've created a brand literally from a kitchen table at 19. You've become eponymous in terms of, I think, the sort of, if you talk about British style, you'll be one of the top two, three names that people would mention. The idea that doubt might be the message, the lesson that you want to share would probably seem quite a stretch for most listeners. Tell us why. Tell us actually what might they be missing.
Well, I think that's almost exactly the point. I think everyone has self-doubt. I think I think whether you're a prime minister or you're whoever you are, everyone has self-doubt. No one is very honest about that. And I think it's only kind in a sort of, I think it's interesting talking to my kids and there's all the sort of, you know, obviously this wonderful openness about mental health and all these things that, you know, I feel we're learning from them about being open. And I felt I wanted to share back on how I felt, but with experience. Mm. I think in addition to that, doubt actually is a superpower. Mm-hmm. You know, doubt's what sits on your shoulder going, you're going to mess up. But actually you learn to live with it and it keeps you questioning yourself and pushing yourself, and I think doubt is therefore a really good thing. So I just felt it was right to talk openly about a range of subjects, you know, in my 50 years of this is where I struggled, this is how I got through it, this is, you know, and just to share that. And I've had a nice reaction for the honesty of that, I think.
Well, and I'm just sort of thinking about, you know, tonight we're going to hear from Midori, who is a famous violinist and was made all the more famous because in Carnegie Hall she managed to break three violins, E strings, one after the other. And you just think about that moment of self-doubt, and actually, you've not done it once, you've actually then had to borrow two more violins, that sort of like coping strategy that you need. Now, I thought there were some really excellent ones. Small rituals can reset your mind. The lack of difference between fear and excitement. Failure, not a verdict, kindness. I mean, these are all, is there one of those that's the senior partner in terms of actually the abiding lesson you've learned.
Probably if in doubt, wash your hair. Only it's such a stupid thing, but it's that thing where if you sort of feel good in yourself, you are more able to kind of cope somehow. I mean, just for me, a sort of, you know, a tidy bedroom can make my day much better, for example. But no, I think the simple fact is that everyone feels the same way. Anyone who pretends they're uber confident, I mean, if they are, then good luck to them. But I think mostly they don't feel that way. And I think, you know, I think we just need to be a bit kinder to each other. Yes. Do you know what I mean? And I feel as a, you know, as a woman of my age now, that actually to say it as it is, that's the kindest thing I can do to people that, you know, want to, you know, learn from my experience.
It's funny, I think of live orchestral music as quite a kind experience. I think it's one of the reasons why a lot of people just, the heartbeat lessons, you feel safe, you feel that you're in an environment where human kindness prevails, whether that's just the teamwork or the audience experience. But I wonder actually whether that's a central part of what you experience when you come to something like this, in terms of one of the reasons why we relate as we do, perhaps in a way you don't relate to a CD or listening on stream.
Well, I think there's also the in some ways the vulnerability. I mean, you know, if you play the wrong note and it's out of tune, you are very exposed. So, I mean, so it's exciting, you know. Mm. And anyway, there's nothing like live music. Just I think the physicality of it, I think the vibrations, quite literally. You know, there's something amazing about like, you know, that's entirely different, I think. So yeah, I find it. I think definitely has a physical effect on me, and it's very special. So thank you for that treat.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I mean, and I think there are lessons to learn from two sides of the creative industry, because, you know, here you've got an orchestra, which is a creative asset, part of, I suppose, Britain's reputation around the world, but so are its creative industries, of which, you know, you are a leading name in that. When you look at the sort of state of the creative industries right now in the UK, how are we faring? How's the British brand travelling abroad, do you think?
I think it's always good, and I think it's still really good. Mm. I mean, if I look at my the sort of sectors I'm involved in, fashion actually is having an exciting new moment. There's new leadership, and there's a sense of a lot of actually just new brands coming through. So there's a nice moment that's happening in fashion. I think British fashion does something that's very special. It's very experimental. Often they're not the biggest businesses, unfortunately, but often they tend to have huge influence, and often there's a lot of British designers that are actually employed in brands overseas. So it has a very important place. I mean, London, I'm talking about the UK, but if I just talk about London, it's just the most amazing city. I think it's so easy for us.
Why? What's your London? What makes it special?
My London is huge. It's diverse. It's old and new for me. I spend hours and hours walking around London for pleasure. That's like my sad, nerdy thing. Sometimes actually with a guide, it's an amazing woman who's an ex-divorce lawyer. He's called Meg Ryder. And her great-grandfather actually was Charles Booth, who mapped all the poverty areas of did all the mapping of London. And we'd sort of chip off bits of London and go for walks, and, you know, literally after work, and just do an area and learn all the history of that area and end up in some lovely pub somewhere. And learning is fun. London is just enormous.
So exploration.
Oh, it's just so exciting. Mm. But I think London mixes old and new so well. Mm. And I think that's what our creative industries do. You know, if you look at architects and how, you know, you're in the City of London's an amazing place. You've got some incredibly old buildings. You know, next to something that's absolutely cutting edge and modern. And I think that is very, very exciting.
And how does that travel in your view? I mean, you are a global brand as well. People, as we've just seen with the state visit, you know, it will sort of, you know, gift your products because they know it has a reputation that travels. When customers come through the door, when they actually sort of come to shop from overseas, what do you think what's the dream they're buying into in terms of, I suppose, the British dream?
I think that there's, because of the history we have, there's, I think that brings obviously a sort of sense of trust in craftsmanship, because, you know, sort of, you know, long trades tend to deliver beautiful work, and I mean, we can't be complacent on that, of course, and quite a lot of it has left, but I still think there is an eye and a craft and sort of respect of materials that is considered a very British trait. You think about all the German streets and the handmade suits and the beautiful shoes and all the things that you think about in the UK. But I also think that we are, so there's a kind of confidence and trust there, but I also think that we then completely mess that up.
I was going to say, your shows are known for being right. They're right out there. You're going to sort of be experimental, anarchic. You're going to sort of look at things not in that kind of traditional craft. Well, that might be part of the ingredients, but there's also something about pushing the frontier.
And I think that's the combination that's exciting. And I think you have that in spades in London. And I think you see it in the creative industry. You know, if you take a theatre or you take a film, you know, there's always that sense of history. But I think there's a confidence to mess with it. And that's when you get exciting progress and change, you know, when you play with things. So I think, and that comes out of this, for me, it comes out of the city, you know, whether it's me hanging around the V&A or going to Tate or coming here or, you know, looking at the architecture or seeing some amazing new area that's emerging. You're going to Battersea Power Station last weekend and wandering around there and seeing those massive turbine halls. You know, it's just exciting.
Yeah, but I mean, if you were to look at the national zeitgeist, I mean, doubt's the title of your book. You might say doubt's the title of the zeitgeist as well, in terms of actually a period of time where we are questioning what it means to be British, questioning ourselves, questioning our confidence. I mean, in terms of that side of the UK, I mean, how does fashion help deliver an answer? How does creativity help deliver an answer? Can it?
I mean, it's so funny. Do you remember that time just before the Olympics when every sort of taxi ride or anyone you spoke to was like, oh, it's going to be terrible, you know, it's just going to be awful, it's embarrassing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it sort of happened and it's
brilliant.
So great. You know, from that moment the opening ceremony started all the way through to the volunteers. Do you remember the volunteers?
Yes, absolutely.
And I think, you know...
And the army coming out.
The army, the architecture, the new build, the fact that we delivered it all on time. It was, and the weather, I mean, who knew? But I sort of feel actually deep down, there is a really lovely confidence. Deep down, there's also a sense of self-deprecation and sort of, you know, slightly kind of grumbling. But actually, I think Brits know that they're good.
Right.
They know there's something special here. And I think that shines through.
So does a Festival of Britain moment appeal? I mean, is that on the cards? It's going to happen. I mean, is that our new Olympic moment, do you think?
I haven't read much about it. I never love going backwards. I always love going forwards,
right.
Honestly.
So, yes. Good idea from the 50s.
But I'm sure it will be amazing. And there's so much creativity in the city that I'm sure it'll really deliver. But I think it's always good to showcase what we do. And actually, sometimes it reminds ourselves. I think that was the point of the Olympics. I think we needed a bit of a kick up the arse and sort of saying, you know what, come on, it's pretty great.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to moan, isn't it? I mean, us Brits are pretty good at that. You know, the moment we're sort of, you know, saying, ooh, and then suddenly you realise actually it's been pretty good in other respects. You know, people are flocking here because it's a great place to be.
Well, I think there's that saying, you rarely are as others see you, isn't it? Which is, there is often a big difference between how you regard yourself and how that outside world is. And that might be true of a nation.
I think it's human nature, isn't it? Always. And it's always, the grass is always greener and you always see the bad bits. But actually, I think it's quite important to stop and think that, you know, this is a pretty incredible city, for sure, if I'm sitting here in London today. You know, it's interesting, it's diverse. Yes, it has its problems. Of course it does. It's just, you know, real life. But there's still lots of good stuff to go after.
So let's get right back. Florence, Harpers & Queen, first sale, young entrepreneur. What gets the young Anya started?
I loved business, I think partly because I come from a family of entrepreneurs, so everyone sort of started their own business in my family, and so it felt like my language. And it was also a time actually in the UK where there was a sense of lots of things starting up. It was post that sort of slump, so it was sort of you know, the sort of 80s where suddenly there were, I mean, I remember there was Carphone Warehouse, there was Pret a Manger, and there was sort of, you know, Next was starting up, and suddenly we'd come out of that slight gloom of the 70s. And it felt like actually there was sort of, you know, something
right.
exciting.
Do you think, I mean, because that's interesting, because you're right. I mean, there are lots of things suddenly happened that it changed the way we dressed, the way we ate, the way we, you know, just on pretty much any retail measure anyway, things changed. But do you think that kind of entrepreneurial beat, does that reflect the kind of the state of mind of a country at any one time? I mean, are there lots of new Anyas, do you think, coming up in the UK today?
I think one leads to three, and three leads to nine. I think
right.
That's the interesting thing. So you need a momentum, and I think there was a momentum at that point. I think there'd been quite a tricky patch. It was hard to remember because I was so young, but there was definitely kind of a bit of a doom and gloom era. And I think suddenly it felt like, actually, no, go, go, go. And there was definitely, you know, and you suddenly think, well, they're doing it, that's quite fun, maybe I could do it too. And I really think that momentum is great. And, you know, but there's opportunity here. I mean, it's, you know, listen, things are pretty tough for a lot of people right now. But there's still, you know, you can, you know, you're in a great geographical location. It's English, you've got, you know, British law. You know, there's a number of things which, you know, pretty steady sort of, you know, employment laws, and you know, there's a number of things that actually make it quite a good place to start a business. So I think you know, I felt pretty lucky, and so for me that was what inspired me. And I was lucky enough to have an idea, and lucky enough to have a sort of family who said, you know, listen, if you don't want to go to university, you want to give it a go, why not?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, was great, because often you might not.
And you've had the full journey: start, scale, sell, come back to it. I mean, in terms of like all of those chapters are the, you know, the pillars of the entrepreneurial law, aren't they? I mean, in terms of what you've learned about yourself along the way, what's the advice you'd give to people that are maybe in one part of that journey or another?
Well, I always say it's the most exciting thing you'll ever do. Mm. It's also the hardest. I mean, it's like bare knuckle fighting, right? You know, really, there are moments where you're just like, what am I doing?
I'm just imagining people saying, Annie Heimer was talking about bare knuckle fighting as her experience. But that's tough, right?
It really is. And it's all about your people. It's all about, you know, it's about luck. And you know, the wins are so exciting. The lows are really low.
Yeah.
It's really hard. But I don't think I could do it any other way. I don't know whether you're born an entrepreneur or whether it's, I'm never sure it's nature or nurture. But it's really exciting. And I do believe it's important to encourage entrepreneurs, because I think it's incredible for the economy. I think it's incredible, you know, huge benefits to employment. And I actually think it's so hard starting businesses. You have everything stacked against you all the way, it feels sometimes, that actually they really need to cut some slack for these idiots that decide to start a business.
Have you advised your children to do the same thing? I mean, does it keep on going through the generations, have they learned from their mum?
Well, there's a range. So two of them, I suppose, are sort of self-employed. By that, I mean one's an actor and one's an artist, which is not sure of the word employed, really. But actually, they're doing okay. But I've got a lawyer and a management consultant, an actor and artist, and someone in comms, actually. So a real range. And so, no, they haven't. I feel my job is to sort of actually just say whatever they want to do, great, go for it, and I'm here if it goes wrong.
Right.
And to be there along the way to kind of to nudge and to... You know, you need to be, I think, as parents, the sort of, you know, those people that sit down and just listen. You know, my parents said that to me, like, I'm so worried about this. So not yet, but that's, you know, we'll see.
Just thinking, because we're sort of coming towards the end of our time, and I'm just thinking about, well, back to music, back to that kind of orchestral experience. And I'm thinking about Annie sort of considering a career in music and then leaving that behind. But keeping it as a life passion. What did you take out of music in terms of your life experience? I mean, obviously a love of it, but it has sort of infiltrated, it strikes me, your creativity, your approach. Am I off
no,
off, no, off target?
No, I mean, no. I think, I mean, for me, it's just ultimately when you're making things, you know, you're actually making people feel a certain way. You're making desirable things. And, you know, music does that, doesn't it? It's just music. But it's amazing how it can alter how you feel.
And I think that's very exciting.
Yeah, and that's ultimately what fashion is. You know, it's one of the core principles, actually.
Right.
You know, is actually making people...
Is there a formula to feeling good, do you think? We know, we've heard that. What about the opposite, feeling good?
Sorry,
is there a formula to feeling good? I'm thinking the five lessons to deal with doubt. What are the five lessons? Maybe one or two lessons for feeling good through creativity.
Well, I mean, you know, I always talk about the creative dip, where, you know, you have an idea. This is sort of the opposite of feeling good in a way. But you have an idea and you're really into something. It's great. You love it and you start it, and it gets hard, and then it gets expensive, and then it gets impossible. And then you hate it, and then you hate yourself, and then you're like, ugh. And then you're like, you know, maybe there's a way. And then actually, I think I could do it this way. And then actually, maybe that could be affordable. And suddenly it's actually, this is quite good. And then you look back 5 years later, and actually it was a really great idea. But I think all creativity has that sort of journey.
Yeah.
And I now know, having done it so many times, that in that dip, mostly, not always, but mostly, if you just hold tight, you find your way out. And I think creativity is a weird thing. And I mean, I was looking at something only last week that I loved. I was like, this is the most beautiful product. And I absolutely hated it when I first designed it. Wasn't
right.
into it at all.
And it grows on you over time.
It grows, and you just, sometimes you're just too close to it. So I think, you know, just knowing the process and giving yourself space to do that is really important as well.
That's so interesting. I mean, I'm just sort of thinking also perspective matters in this. I'm thinking, if I could wave a magic wand and allow you to advise the entrepreneur that you were, knowing what you now know, with all of the sort of, I suppose, the success that you've had, the sort of the story that you've had, but if I was to take you back to that very first bag in Florence, the duffel bag, I believe it was, right? There's that moment in terms of, well, there might be something in this. What's the advice you'd give yourself?
I mean, I think it really goes back to doubt, sorry, but I think it's so important, which is that try and park the self-doubt and do what you feel in your gut. You know, I think that gut reaction is more important than any business plan. It's just like, if you really believe in something, you can move mountains, honestly. So I think it's just, don't doubt, go for it. You know, listen, learn, you know, so much you don't know, learn, listen, you know, pivot, all of those things. But actually, if you feel it and you believe in it, go for it.
And did you doubt back then, or was it?
Yeah, all the way. Doubt is absolutely all the way. I remember there's a million. But I kind of knew that I felt that product was going to sell. And I then knew that, you know, the next step was that, and I felt I should open a store, and then I felt I should open more stores, and then we go to Japan, and we go, you know, da-da-da-da-da. And I think you've just got to trust that. And sometimes, actually, the ideas that are best are not the ones that are right. They're the ones that you also execute well, or you do with great passion or authenticity. You know, I'm a great believer in being all in. You know, enthusiasm is huge. And of course, it's all about your team. I mean, I just celebrated this morning 25 years of lovely Sue, who's worked with me. And we were sitting there laughing at all the stories. I mean, I can't tell you how many, I've forgotten most of them, funny stories of absolute disasters. You know, it's about basically not giving up. Really, that's what success is.
Well, I would just say, in bringing it all together, I think all in is a very good phrase to describe your personality. I think your leadership style, and I think also the contribution you've made with your business. I mean, it's an amazing story. And thank you very much for sharing it on Journeys. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.